not many, but people who will talk about it, honestly. But I can tell you, what happens in the emergency room is happening in the patient rooms as well. It's through the hospital, same across the board. Main focus is not really interpreter, but the experience at the hospital, what the deaf person needs, all that is for the person, the patient. Communication is involved in that, but other issues arise from that lack of communication, not just an interpreter, but it's about patient experience. Focused on interpreter, yeah, but we need to involve all of those things in relation to culture sensitivity training, all of that sort of thing needs to happen here. Did you get that, Dean? Yes, the interpreter got that.
Yes, thank
culture
you.
Sensitivity
thank
training.
You.
Yes, I got
culture
that.
Sensitivity.
I have an experience. Rochester has a large deaf community. Oh, sorry, some deaf people can't see me. So. My pregnant friend arrived at the hospital. Baby was about to arrive. They got an unqualified interpreter, one that wasn't only not qualified, but wasn't certified at all. And, you know, we couldn't wait for another interpreter to arrive, so we just kind of tried to work out communication. And that lack of communication was so awkward because we were sitting across from people that didn't really understand what was going on. And you had the hospital there had an uncertified interpreter, unqualified interpreter, and somebody just kind of sitting there that quote new sign. And it was an awkward situation because this is such a private time. And qualified, certified interpreters, you know, have that rule of ethics that they have to follow. And so people were kind of looking in the room and what was going on. There was no privacy at all. There was no support, nothing. So the baby was born and the nurse came in speaking. Deaf person understood nothing. They were speaking in a microphone, it seemed like, and were asking what was being said, what was being said. My brother-in-law wasn't involved. He doesn't know sign, so he couldn't even interpret for the patient. We had no need to know what's going on with our baby, and the patient had no clue. In the hospital, in the hallway, they have like this sign. And so we kind of pointed that we needed an interpreter to know what's going on. We need an interpreter. And it just kind of went around, around, around. Do you have a staff interpreter? Do you have somebody that can come? Nurse didn't know who to get. The interpreting came from a different agency. They came from the Spanish interpreting agency. So they were trying to interpret in Spanish, and we're all deaf. It was so confusing. It was a terrible experience. And so when we left, they were struggling with breastfeeding. They were struggling with car seat and all those situations that have to do with how you inform pregnant or new mothers. It was all confusing. It was a terrible experience. That's an example of what happens if deaf don't have access. We don't plan ahead. We don't have the correct policies in place. And if people don't know those policies, it's great to have them, but if your staff don't know, it's not helpful.
Thank you. It's very important.
I just want to add, cultural competency is not just a service issue, it's a quality issue, because you have to be able to understand what the patient's needs are, what the clinical needs are, in order to provide the appropriate care. So, and we see this with many groups that we have to have cultural competency. And so I personally thank you for coming today And I know that the hospital is hearing it and will do their best to address it. And we will, as an oversight committee, follow up to make sure that it's being addressed and that there's improvement.
I echo those sentiments. And go ahead.
I have a short little story, if I could. My experience here at this hospital. If you don't mind, I'll stand here. Hello. Try not to be in anybody's way. Hi, I'm TJ. And I recently moved here. Here in Palm Springs. I live here in Palm Springs. I moved here with my parents. My daughter was born here. Good, healthy baby. Thank goodness, yeah. But luckily, we had some struggles, but we have a good, healthy baby. We found a way to get an interpreter to meet our needs. I asked over there, sorry, the light is bothering me. My wife has a cochlear implant. I'm deaf, obviously. My wife speaks, but we prefer using sign as our main mode of communication. You know the healthy classes for parents, new parents? Okay. So I asked for an interpreter for that class so we could learn, just like everybody else, how to be good parents to my new baby. So they introduced me to the ADA liaison. What's best for maybe VRI or interpreter, which would be best? I didn't get to decide. They discussed it. What's best for me? They discussed it. So there was no back and forth communication between me and the hospital. They chose what was best for the parenting class. And 2 hours, we had one interpreter. That is not cool. You don't have an interpreter for 2 hours. That's not right. 2 hours, you need two interpreters. They need a break. Their brain can't work like that. I'm sorry, the interpreter might know what I'm talking about, but I can't say anything because he's interpreting. So I'll let you know, if you have a meeting more than 2 hours, you need more than one interpreter. So the interpreter was tired and kind of asked for a second interpreter. And the interpreter today knows how that feels, right? So now you know, low education, if you have a long meeting, you should have two interpreters. So follow up, you know, from that class, they gave me VRI, the video relay. I didn't like it, not what I wanted, but it's what the hospital offered and didn't talk to me about my needs. They decided for me. There was a lack of real equality in my opinion. It wasn't fair. So we used VRI through delivery. My wife kind of had to manipulate her head to find the VRI, to look for the screen. It was not effective for her at all. We asked for an interpreter. So finally, an interpreter from RISE, I think, did come in. Realized that how important that interpreter was that finally arrived, because we kept asking, kind of advocated for ourselves. And so the baby went to NICU, was there for a few weeks. I wasn't comfortable with what was provided, so it would be nice if you would ask a deaf person what they need in order to get effective communication, rather than having those conversations among yourselves and deciding for us. So you should have services ready.
Thank you. It's wonderful. Good. We appreciate your attendance. It's so important to hear from the community to make this hospital a better place, to meet everybody's needs. Is there anybody else that wishes to speak? Mr. Hank?
Yeah, just after hearing this and getting this email I got yesterday, it kind of falls into the same issue. Essentially, if I read correctly, I read this email yesterday about a new practice the district is going to be doing in not representing the full minutes in a written form on the web on certain meetings and only done by recording. So I would think that these people would be disadvantaged by that new policy.
Oh, I don't think that's right.
Is that not right?
No.
So it will be
written
as well, total?
And audio.
Okay, because I was told it was going to be abbreviated minutes.
Am I wrong in reading? They're called action minutes?
Action minutes?
Mm-hmm.
So it won't have the full details of what is discussed at the meeting?
I think what we would do is, as a part of this process, we should have that conversation. There has been a lot of conversation in trying to not have every minute detail that's in there. But I think the issue you're raising is a real one, so we'll just have to take it back and work with the community about that, certainly understand. And so we've been working with legal counsel about it, and so let's see if we can find, between the board and the community, a happy medium to do that. Because I understand, now, if you're you know, not able to listen through, audio, you ought to be able to
read.
But it's an issue of stuff that is not germane to what sort of the overall topic is. But I think we as a staff would want to work with the community to address it.
When I hear that, though, here's what I'm hearing, and you obviously correct me, please. I hear it as a censorship of public comments, because what you're doing is you're detailing minute details. I may be interested in those minute details. Those minute details may be significant to me and my concerns. So I'd rather have all of what is discussed and presented there in written form for me to decide what is minute, what is important, what is not important as a citizen of this community and the district. That's where I stand.
Right, and I'm not dismissing.
I know, I just want to get that out there.
No, I'm not dismissing at all, because I think it's full transparency, and I think the board's process has been full transparency.
Right, and it has been so far, and when I read that, that concerned me. Just putting it out there.
No, and like I said, I think we will move to address it with you, because I think we'll be directed, but we'll do it anyway, because
you're
making a legitimate point. I think we should sit down and work through what the minutes have been like and what they can be in the future and should be. So I'm agreeing with you, Hank.
I get it.
Okay, I'm agreeing with you.
You
have a legal counsel that said there's certain things, so we want to sit down with the community and make it work.
I guess the question is do our minutes supposed to be a transcription verbatim of a meeting? And at least most of the boards and committees I've been on, that's not the case. On the other hand, I think if there's a recording of it and somebody wants to read, wants to not only hear but read what the recording says, that could be transcribed. But there's a difference between minutes and a transcription.
Okay, and now I'll go by my own personal experience in the past years. When I come here a few years ago, I spoke to an issue, and when it was represented in the minutes, it was totally different from what I said.
That by the way, that's exactly why we don't do a transcription.
So this is
and
what
we stop paraphrasing. We stop trying to paraphrase what other people said and just put with the topic. And then if somebody was interested in seeing exactly what was said, they could listen to it. Or now we'd have to actually make a written copy of it if somebody wanted to hear it. But minutes, again, minutes are different than transcription.
Are there?
And what I had done for my own personal concerns about what was represented and what I had actually said, I had moved forward whenever I do speak, except today, unfortunately, because I didn't plan on speaking, believe it or not, is I wanted to just write down everything I was going to say, present it to the person who does the minutes, which I've done, and make sure it's entered into the record that way. So my points are appropriately what I feel is represented into the minutes.
I think.
Is that still going to be done? I guess that's my next question.
I think there's a couple different things. I think what would be helpful in this as a part of this is for our learning to understand every kind of communication that would be acceptable to the community to do that. So that we can look at the difference between, and I'm not making a judgment, that's ultimately up to the board,
right.
Looking at full transcription of a tape, looking at TDY and those types of lines, it would be helpful to hear from you and the community what are all, in addition to just a full absolute thing of the minutes, which is what President Zendel was talking about, some of the issues that we had there. So I would ask, as a part of this dialogue, if we could know what the sort of realm is. There's probably multiple options of doing that. But any time in the past that there's ever been any written information, it gets passed, it's been put in the minutes. But that's different from the policy that we were just starting to implement around phone, and we hear the concern.
Okay.
So, but it would be helpful because there are several options in the community. Mm-hmm. Let us evaluate everything, and you tell us here's what we think is the best way to do it.
And when I heard some of the feedback just now about, well, some minutes at other meetings aren't fully displayed, to me it's like, well, why does it matter about what other people are doing? Why can't we think within ourselves in this committee and in the district and say, we as this district want all concerns publicly out there and let the public digest it for what it ever is said and make their own conclusions.
Thank you.
And is there any harm in that? And that's what I was wondering.
No, that's the purpose of this committee, is to hear from the community.
Right.
And hear their concerns and how we can improve. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Is there anyone else?
How about you?
I would say, please stop the TTY business. We have email, we have video relay services. TTY is antiquated. It's old. We have full-time ASL interpreters on video relays. It's wonderful if you hire an ASL interpreter to work here, be on staff at the hospital. Maybe that would be an answer, to have someone on staff at the hospital at all times for any of these situations.
Mm-hmm.
Certified interpreter would be best. To add to that, interpreter for the hospital? Okay, that's good. But let me add, a medical interpreter would be best. You know, someone who kind of specializes, not just an interpreter, but somebody who can specialize in medical interpreter.
Mm-hmm. Great. Are there anybody else that wishes to speak? We have a nice large crowd.
We have 2 seats over here.
There's 2 seats
Matt,
over here.
You're gonna, Marianne. A short little addition. Not just about being happy, it's about being safe. It's our health you're talking about.
Thank you, very important. Anybody else? Go ahead.
Yes, I would ask this committee to instruct staff to find if there are any regulatory requirements with regard to these kinds of translational services for a level 2 trauma center.
There are many.
There are many,
and they were reaffirmed in the recent ACA.
Do we meet them?
I don't know, but we should.
Well,
I'm not hearing we are, from what I'm hearing.
Well, I would like to know what those requirements are.
We'll
get those for you. Thank you.
There's actually, federal law, and there is state law. There's more that's added to the ACA. There are also state law. And the state law, one of the questions I was going to ask, whether we want to get into it, is, but there are state laws that applies to the health plans themselves. There is state law and federal law that applies to the hospitals themselves, and we should, on behalf of the community, be looking at all of those laws and making sure that the hospital is compliant with those laws.
And that's the purpose of this committee. Anybody else bring up any concerns, issues? Great, okay, shall we move on? Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm a medical student. I'm hearing by deaf parents, and just my experience growing up with them, I've encountered a lot of people who don't know what to do when there's an ASL interpreter in the room, and I think it falls upon the deaf to explain what's happening, though that should not be their job. So maybe there's, and then as a medical student, my experience is that there's still no training for us as developing providers to know what to do in that circumstance. So maybe there's something that comes, I don't know what's implemented here, if anything, but if there's not some sort of training program or some sort of quick, like, this is what you should do if there's an ASL interpreter or a deaf patient, that would be great.
Thank you.
Maybe it's a part of orientation.
Mm-hmm. And there are obviously HIPAA issues too that need to be addressed.
Hello, my name is Lisa from Riverside. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Lisa Price. I'm the director of Center on Deafness and Empire in Riverside. We are under the Department of Social Services and Deaf Community Access. We provide access services for all deaf and hearing impaired and hard of hearing within Empire. My experience with other hospitals within the community in Riverside, we've actually gone out to their facilities to provide deaf sensitivity trainings, and it's been very effective. And we approach them and the needs that they need. So whatever their needs are, we're able to meet their needs, whether it's with interpreting services, and we can devise a program that's specific to your needs. And making sure that your staff are on it and they understand it and able to move forward in an effective manner.
And you'll leave us your contact information?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I can definitely do that. I can be my business contact.
Great. Anyone else? Good. Well, it was wonderful to have you here and bring up your concerns, and we'll certainly follow up. That's the purpose of this committee. Shall we move on to the agenda? We had introductions, and Mr. Mitch, would you like to introduce yourself to people?
I'm Mitch Blumberg. I'm chairman of the governing board at Desert Regional Medical Center.
A very important person.
Yep.
Great. And happy Nurses Week to all of our nurses here.
Happy Nurses Week to you.
That's great. All right. We have the meeting minutes. Do you approve the meeting minutes?
I move they be approved.
Okay, they're approved.
Are there any comments?
Is there any comments on the minutes? All right, hearing none, they're approved. Do we have any old business? No old business. New business. We have our speaker here, Steve McCotter, who's our patient, director of patient experience. When I was a patient here, he even came in and said hello to me. Thank you.
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for allowing me to come here and speak today. I wanted to have an opportunity to be able to share with the members of the healthcare districts and also with the community at large some of the things that Desert Regional Medical Center is currently working on to increase our patient experience. And we're doing that through something called a Patient Experience Council. That's a steering committee that we've put together at Desert Regional made up of frontline staff, management, directors, and our administrative staff as well, our administration to address some of the specific ways that we can improve patient experience. So one of the ways that I like to start any of my talks is to really kind of define for us what the patient experience is. And the Beryl Institute defines the patient experience as the sum of all interactions shaped by an organization's culture that influence patient perceptions across the continuum of care. And when we talk about the sum of all interactions, it really illustrates for us how the patient experience isn't necessarily about nursing. It isn't about any one particular department in the hospital, but it really is every interaction that a patient has from the first time that they encounter Desert Regional Medical Center all the way through, and it even extends beyond the time that they may be discharged from the hospital. It's shaped by an organization's culture. And so, you know, it begs the question of what type of culture do we as a hospital encourage? Is it a culture of high reliability? Is it a culture of accountability? Do we encourage and respect one another and our patients? Those are going to make a huge impact in how our patients are ultimately experiencing care. And of course, it's the patient perception that really is the most important thing. It isn't who we say that we are. It ultimately is going to be who our patients tell us that we are. And so, and it's across the continuum of care. So not only does it include the things that actually happen on the inpatient side at Desert Regional Medical Center, but it's also going to include our relationships with primary care partners, with subacute facilities, every area where a patient's going to access healthcare across the community. So, and this model here just kind of shows how the patient and the family are in the center of our model. And then the blue circle are all those people who actually put their hands on the patients, and then there's a whole team of people around them who are going to be supporting those people who are actually at the bedside taking care of patients. So it really is a collaborative effort. We have initiated what we call the patient experience playbook, and it's something that Tenet has been working on for all of its hospitals, and it's a very prescriptive playbook, and we're implementing the initiatives that are associated with it. So some of those initiatives are daily huddles, and I'll talk about each one of these things individually. Daily huddles that happen at each shift change. Bedside handoff report in the room with a patient. For those of you who may not be aware, a bedside handoff report happens at shift change, and it's when two nurses will come into the room to discuss the care with of their upcoming shift with the patient. Purposeful hourly rounding, so that someone is going to be in the room with our patients every hour. They can count on someone coming into the room to check on what we call the four P's, and I'll talk a little bit about those in just a moment, but their pain, their personal needs, positioning, and proximity, whether they have everything that they need close by their bed and close by in reach. S3 Teach 3 is a technique that we use around MedPass, medication distribution, so I'll talk a little bit about that. And then nurse leader rounding for validation. So this is the responsibility of the management, nurse management staff, who are going to be validating that each one of these other initiatives are happening, so that we can make sure that these things are being hardwired and they're happening consistently. Broader leader rounding. We at Desert Regional Medical Center, we're now including multiple layers of rounding, so that patients may have multiple different care teams that might be coming in and checking on them and asking them specific questions about their perception of care. We also have a patient and family advisory council, and there are actually some of our council members that are here today, so I thank them for being here. But they are actually members of the community. They've been patients at Desert Regional Medical Center, and they're onboarded as volunteers to help us with some of our improvement efforts. And then we've also been doing ADIT training for our residents. So as many of you may know, we have residents who are currently in the facility, and their future, well, they are physicians, and they'll be practicing on their own soon, but they're in a learning phase, and we do ADIT training, which I'll talk about in just a second what that is.
What is ADIT, Sam?
Sure, it's a Studer tool from Quint Studer, who was the president of Baptist Hospital in Pensacola, Florida. When he took over that hospital, they had some terrible patient experience scores, and they rose into the top 95th percentile in the nation very quickly, and now they consult. And it's a practice that we use when interacting with our patients. It means that we acknowledge our patients, addressing them by things like the name that they choose. We introduce ourselves and our colleagues. We give them a lot of duration. We give them an idea of how long things are going to take. Explanation, we want to explain everything that's happening to a patient while they're in the hospital, risks and benefits, those types of things. And we want to thank them. Thank them for the opportunity to be of service. Obviously, at Desert Regional Medical Center, we don't create lawnmowers or cars. What we are is of service to people, often at times of very great difficulty. So it's a privilege to be able to do that. So with our daily huddles, these happen at shift change. And on each of the nursing units, we actually have our patient experience scores. Our patient experience is measured by press gaming. And so they survey a statistically significant sample of our inpatients once they're discharged from the hospital. And so each of the nursing units is actually shows where the hospital sits as a composite score, and then also where their individual units are sitting with patient experience. They also have an area on the dashboards where they can put down a goal, their specific goals for the upcoming 12-hour shift ahead. So, you know, it could be a complete bedside handoff with the patient, purposeful hourly rounding, or something as simple as warm washcloths, you know, after lunch for patients. So each unit gets an opportunity to decide what they're going to focus on for the next 12 hours, and then they put that up. And those are public areas where our patients and visitors, anyone to the unit, is able to see those. So to telling the story, the whiteboard really is where we tell the story about the patient. It's really a collaborative, it's a collaboration that happens between our patients and all the care team that are coming into the room. And so we want our whiteboards to be completely filled out. So each of the caregivers who comes in, this is from our physical therapists, our nurse, the nursing assistants, our physicians, we encourage them to put their name on the board so that the patient knows who's taking care of them. Our whiteboards also have places where their personal belongings can be put here. You know, on this particular board says the patient has their own CPAP machine, so it's a breathing machine, just so we make sure that we don't lose those types of things at the time of discharge. We want to make sure that we're all working together to make sure that the patient's belongings are taken care of. It has an area to keep up with their pain score and where they are currently with pain and when their next pain medication is going to be available to them. Contact information. And then there's an area down in the lower right-hand corner where we get the patient is able to define what really great care means to them. And I also encourage each of the nursing staff to put the patient's first name or what they like to be called on the board so that anyone who comes into the room rounding would be able to immediately address the patient and use their preferred name. So for this particular patient, they wanted to have coffee in the afternoon. They love coffee in the afternoon. So it's just something that allows us to be able to provide something a little extra special for them. So bedside handoff is something that is a must-have for us. So when we do a bedside handoff, this happens at shift change. Obviously, the oncoming nurse is going to take over the care from the nurse that's going to be leaving. And when they come into the room together, they're going to obviously do hand hygiene. They're make sure that they gel in before they come into the room. And then they're setting the expectation with the patient that this is an hourly rounding facility, that bedside handoff happens at each shift change, so the patient has an understanding of what to expect. So they go through the handoff, which is basically the nurse is going to explain everything that's happened during the last shift and give the patient and the nurse that's oncoming the information that they need so that it's a collaborative process, right? The patient gets an opportunity to ask any questions. If there's family that are there, they're included in that so that everyone's on the same page. They update the whiteboard. The oncoming nurse will update the whiteboard while the outgoing nurse is going to update, obviously, the incoming nurse through the patient, right, including them in the conversation. So, again, they're going to check all of the safety things like the pumps, the IV lines, all of those sorts of things at that time. Make sure that the room is tidy and clean, and then thank the patient for the opportunity to be of service before they leave. So a number of things happen when you do an excellent bedside handoff report. Obviously, safety is enhanced because you have more eyes who are actually looking at anything. If someone might some incorrect information is going to be given, you have family and the patient there who are able to say, well, no, actually, I think it's like this, right? And then you're able to make sure that the safety is increased. And then, of course, ultimately, patient experience is going to be enhanced because the patient gets the understanding that it's a more transparent organization. They have all the same information that their nursing staff do. So there are a couple of things that you'll see while you're up on the nursing unit associated with bedside handoff. One is that the patient gets an opportunity to make the decision whether they want to participate in that or not. Obviously, shift change happens very early in the morning. It happens at 7 a.m. between 7 and 7:30. Some patients may want to sleep, but we don't want to make that decision for the patient. We want them to make that decision for themselves whether or not they want to be included. And so you'll see one of these outside of the room that allows the patient themselves signs off on that to make sure that that they want to be included or not. So hourly rounding, purposeful hourly rounding is also another must-have for us. And what this means is that there's going to be someone from the nursing staff is going to be in the room every hour to check on a patient and to anticipate their needs. So ultimately, they don't have to use the call light as often. So basically, when a nurse comes into the room at the hourly round, they explain that they're doing their hourly round, and they're going to check on what we call the four P's. And so again, this is that they're going to check to make sure that the patient needs to use the bathroom. That's what we call personal needs. Proximity, to make sure that they have everything close by them so that they don't have to get up out of bed, right? They want to make sure that everything's close by. Any of their pain, we want to address any pain needs that they have. And then their positioning, make sure that they're getting moved and that they're comfortable. So they want to ask before they leave, is there anything else that I can do for you? Closing the door for the patient's privacy if available. So these are our four P's. We met as a nursing executive council to define those. Different hospitals have different sets of P's. We've defined these four as being the most important for us to make sure that we're checking on. One of the things that you might also notice here is instead of asking our patients during the hourly round if they have to use the bathroom, we're encouraging our nurses to say that I'm available to assist you to the bathroom now, basically so that we can anticipate that need ahead of time. So we want to get them up and get them to the bathroom assistance. And this, of course, also helps so that our patients don't feel the need to get up on their own and potentially have a fall. So patient safety is really enhanced this way.
Steve, could you just clarify for me if a patient's sleeping?
Sure.
At that hour, do you wake them up and say, or do they let them sleep?
Sure. So also, these are the kinds of things we want to discuss with our patients ahead of time. But generally at night when our patients are sleeping, we would round on them every 2 hours instead of every one. And you can see that here on our hourly rounding log. These are the evening hours. And we expect that our nurses are going to come in every 2 hours to check on them. But generally, an hourly round still would be a nurse coming into the room and can still check to make sure that the room has all the safety needs that are there, check the lines, all of those sorts of things, even if they don't necessarily have to wake the patient up.
But that form you showed where the patient says, wake me and include me or let me sleep.
That was a shift
change. Do not disturb.
That was a shift change.
Yeah. Oh, okay, right. You're referring to right. the hourly.
Yeah, for the hourly round. Generally, if a patient is sleeping, we would still, one of the things, we do have this hourly rounding log. It's in the patient's room, and it's actually over by their whiteboard. So what this means is that instead of just being able to look in and check and see if a patient needs any help or not, we can't count that as an hourly round. We actually have our staff go into the room so that they will actually initial that they've been there to fill out this form. One of the other things that's very helpful about this form is that if you have a family member or a loved one in the hospital and you come in, you haven't been able to be there during the day, and you come in and you check, if you can see that this has been filled out, then you know that the staff have been in there regularly checking on your loved one. So it's also a way that we can provide that that assurance. Ask Through Teach 3 deals with how we pass our medications. So before anyone passes medication to the patient, they have the patient ask them three questions. So the nurse is going to have the patient ask three questions of her or him. That's going to be, what is the name of the medication? Why do I need to take it? And what are the possible side effects for the medication? So studies have shown that by the patient actually asking those questions, it triggers them to be more alert to the actual answer that the nurse then gives. And so ultimately, patients have a much better understanding once they're discharged from the hospital of any new medication that they have been receiving, and then potentially, you know, the safety, the side effects, what they might be. So
what do you do for, say, somebody who is in, you know, not in ICU, but is in critical condition and is taking hourly meds? They're in no place to probably even know if they can even speak what their medications are.
Sure.
So how do you deal with that?
That's a great question. So actually, very often what we try to do is include any family or loved ones who are there. So very often in the ICU, you may have a family member or a primary care partner who will be there. And so we still want to encourage that primary care partner to ask those questions as well. I mean, ultimately, we want to make sure that our patients are educated on their medications and any medications that are going to come before they leave. And very often this takes a number of times. So this is something we do consistently. Tish, you have a question?
What about people with visual language? How do they communicate? So they're coming in every hour, but if there's not an interpreter or whatever,
right?
Present, what happens?
So So currently, and after this, the conversation that we've been having today, we're certainly going to be taking a lot of the information that you've been giving us, and we may be making some changes. But historically, what we have done is that we would want to have at least the electronic interpreter through our iPad system would be in the room, so that any time that we're communicating with any of our hearing impaired patients, that they would have the ability to use that translation service. Now, certainly, I do. We've been hearing, obviously, that some of the concerns that have been with that, but that's currently.
Excuse me, Steve. Okay. iPad system. I work here. I'm unfamiliar with that. Is that available on all the floors? I haven't heard.
Absolutely. Our security team at any time.
Laura, you work in ICU. Do you have an iPad system on your floor? Because I've worked from multiple units and I haven't seen that or heard about it.
Anytime that we have any one who comes in who's is deaf or hard of hearing, then what we would encourage is that we call security 6214. They immediately bring an iPad system over, and the iPad stays with the patient for the entire time that they're there, so that we have the interpreting services there.
Okay, so I just let you know the communication isn't out there for the nurses.
Yeah, I said I think a lot of what we're hearing is what's in writing and what the current policies are by way of using the VLR and calling for interpreters when an individual requests an interpreter is not permeated the organization. So this has been very helpful to understand what people are actually experiencing, because it's clear that that everybody is not in the same place.
Yeah, I totally.
But we do. I actually have seen it and logged on to it. But the mere fact that you could be a nurse there.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I want you to be aware that as nurses on the floor, ICU, here I represent the rest.
No,
I do not. Believe me, I would know about it.
And I do believe you, because it is what the individuals in this room are experiencing.
Yeah.
So
great. Thank you.
It's clear.
Comment?
You have the VRI system, but really listen to the deaf people and ask. Your survey doesn't include that, the VRI system. You like it, you don't like it, none of us like it. It's a negative thing. What's the feedback? We don't like the VRI system. It doesn't work. We need a live interpreter. You think, oh, it's precious, it's wonderful, we've got this system. But nobody even understands how it works. So it's just not effective.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Go ahead.
There's too many issues with VRI. People don't know how to use it. Technology problems, technical problems. Patient moves with the VRI, or say the person has a hurt arm and can't move in the direction that the machine is. They can't change that. It's very limited, has limited mobility. We need to see. Deaf need to see. And so if that's not working properly or has limited mobility, then we can't see it. It's not effective communication. It's not flexible for us. So if a baby is being born, are you moving that to be visible to the mother and to the father or the other people in the room? Excuse me, I need to move this around. I know your baby's being born, but I need to move this machine. That's just not effective. So it's very hard to use. Live interpreter for most deaf people is much better. We see the facial expressions. It's a 3D language. And so you're getting all of the information more clearly. And if something's missed, we can catch it by body language, or if something's missed, you know, the interpreter can ask. So there's less miscommunication going on. There's less background noise in the room. Not have that machine. So if the interpreter can't hear the doctor, they can say so. It's just that VRI system just not effective. So it's not flexible for people. It's awkward, and it makes an awkward situation. So it's not a positive patient experience. And so the microphone that uses is hard for people to understand. So even hearing people have a problem with it. And so it's not a natural voice to where somebody can understand everything that's being said.
Thank you.
One of the ways that we are able to monitor the hardwiring process is through nurse leader rounding. And nurse leader rounding entails that a nurse manager during each shift chooses a nurse or two and will round on all of the patients that nurse is currently taking care of to ask questions specifically about how well these different playbook initiatives are occurring. So they will check in with that staff member ahead of time, let them know that they're doing a leader round, and then they go in and talk to the patient by themselves. Afterwards, once they've gotten the information, then they debrief with the staff and let them know. Generally, starting with the kudos first, I just wanted to let you know that as I spoke to your patients, they felt that you did a really great job in connecting with them and getting them to the bathroom. They really appreciated that. One of the things that we saw is that several of your patients said that they needed to use a call light to get some pain medication. So obviously we would prefer that during your hourly round that you are addressing pain needs at that time. So basically it's an opportunity to coach an individual nurse at that time. If the nurses do particularly well, you may not have to round on them again for quite some time, but if you're actively working on something, then you would round on them regularly to make sure that they were improving. So this way, then of course, the playbook initiatives get hardwired with each of the individual nurses. So, and they use a rounding tool for that, right? Here's an example of what one of those rounding tools might look like. So you would have specific questions, and it's for a specific room and patient, so. Broader leadership rounding is also another thing that we've really embraced at the hospital. And so each Tuesday and Thursday in our morning safety huddles, the directors, management team, and the administration, we actually round on our patients and ask them questions about how we're doing with things very similar to the playbook. We also use a rounding tool with specific open-ended questions so that patients have the opportunity to give us direct feedback on how we're doing and ways that we could improve and things that we could do to make their experience more meaningful for them. We bring that information back to our morning huddle, and if there's staff recognition, we actually have cards, thank you cards, that we fill out for our staff to make sure that if they've been recognized that we're giving them those kudos, so that they have a way of publicly acknowledging the work that they're doing and when they're doing well. So we can also correct any issues that we find immediately. It's very helpful when you're actually on the floor and a patient has a concern, if we're able to take care of it right away. I think that that's the best and most meaningful way for us. So. Our Patient and Family Advisory Council is an important part of our playbook. And this is a way that we partner with our patients to make sure that we're improving. And they sit at the table with us and they help us in making improvements and decisions across the facility. We currently have 8 patient advisors and we've worked on a number of different projects that are meaningful for patients. Our Patient and Family Advisory Council updated the patient guide and made sure that it was more meaningful, the content was more meaningful, that it was using language that patients understood. They also did a physician communication video, so they had patient advisors telling their stories, so that some positive stories, some negative stories, but ultimately it's for physicians to improve practice. They've worked on an end-of-life process so that we can come up with a way of identifying patients who may be currently in the active dying process, so that we have a way to acknowledge from staff that, that this is what's going on in a patient room and adjust behavior and also make sure that the family members are going to be supported in that process.
How often do you get to meet?
We meet once a month.
We also have had speaker panels with our patient advisors, with our resident graduate nurses, and they've spoken at some resident events as well, so they are able to tell their story. We also did aided training for residents, and so this is an hour and a half presentation where we have our residents who come in and we talk specifically about practical techniques to improve doctor communication with patients. Things like taking a seat when they're in the room, ways to improve active listening, and other techniques. We also went over all of the social media and press gainy comments that were associated with physicians so that they could learn from direct feedback from patients. All right, and those are some of the things that we're working on. So thank you very much. I really appreciate the time.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
And you start.
Excuse me.
Can I
just ask a question?
Sure.
I work One Central, and on night shift, and I didn't see it addressed in the patient experience. What I see, and I'm hoping in the future, and again, I'm not sure if it's going to be a new policy or if it's a policy going to be in play, but what I see that's distressful for patient experience is we have an opening and closing of units, and unfortunately what we do is we close units at night, even when they're fully staffed. I'll take this for example, One Central. The supervisor will decide, oh, well, let's close One Central and move the patients about to other floors. And this process is done between the hours of 9 and midnight, and sometimes even later, depending on the needs of what's going on, because you just don't have the staff to move everybody so quickly. And the patients are being moved from a single room to either double rooms or just being moved, period, because, okay, I'll give you an experience that was direct, and I'm hopefully no HIPAA violation. So I had a patient on the floor who was going for an open heart surgery. I had a patient with a mom. It's a patient with special needs all his life, so, and I worked PEDS for 20 years, so I know where her head's at. For her, it was a child, even though he was an adult. She's in the room taking care of him, and she's one of the ones that's going to move. And then I have another patient that, for her, felt like she had a whole new life-threatening illness that she never thought she had to deal with before, so she's very emotional. All three of these patients did not want to move. I informed the supervisor of that they did not want to move. He came down and he spoke to each one of them individually. And he said, okay, they agreed to move now. Well, after he left the floor, I had to deal with the emotions of those patients. The first one, the heart surgeon patient. I said, so why weren't you as honest with him, the supervisor, as you were with us, as to why you did not want to move? He said, well, I'm gonna have open heart surgery tomorrow. I do not want to make the people who are going to be taking care of me upset. So he felt intimidated into moving. That's not cool. That's that one case. Then the next one, with the mother and the, for me it's a child, even though it's an adult, and her child. She wants to always be there at the bedside to make sure, because the patient can't communicate. I don't want to get into the full diagnostics, but ultimately, she wants to always be there at the bedside and assist with his needs, which is totally appropriate. But she was going to be moved up to 3 East, which is a double room. And as you already know, Steve, it's a very tight situation for 2 bedroom patients anyway. And she's going to be staying at the bedside. She's going to have to stay up in a chair upright. The chairs are very uncomfortable. Once she was down in One Central, we had a nice recliner chair for her. So I asked her again, why, because it made me look bad, because I'm telling the supervisor they had issues and then suddenly they're agreeable. So they're telling me, well, when he came into the room, it's like, oh, I just give up, because every time I come here, and this is the mother speaking, because he's in the hospital a lot, it happens all the time, and I just give up. I just got to play with the plan. My child needs his medical care. She doesn't want to upset the staff because she's always repeating her visits. And the other one, she said, oh no, no problem. And so I literally brought her up to 3 East. As she's getting off the elevator, it's a very busy floor, 3 East. It was on the full side. She's going into the double room from her single room. She started crying in tears. And I said, wait, what's going on? Why are you upset? She goes, I really didn't want to do this move. But I have to, and I go, hold on. And so I brought her back up to the front desk, and I said, she doesn't want to do this move to a double room. She's just too upset. Is there any way we could accommodate her? So fortunately, I was able to accommodate that one patient, get her over to 3 Sinatra, so she would have a single room. But during that whole time, she was traumatized, she was crying. And then the next morning, I go to speak to my director, and I'm told, I agree with you, I understand you, but at the same time, there's other needs, the financial needs of the hospital. And I'm sorry, in the back of my mind, I know, I hear from Mark, I hear from different district members, Tenet is doing fine making money here at the hospital, which is fine and dandy. Why would they need to disrupt these patients? And it's not just these patients at that one night, it's a reoccurrence. I've seen it over the years I've been working here. Why would they need to disrupt these patients' personal experiences in the hospital for something that's only on paper, because in reality, those patients still are in the hospital, still being cared for. They don't need to be moved at night, but yet we're moving them at night. So getting back to what the director said, so the new policy for me now is not to offer my concerns to the supervisor at night as to why these patients need to move, but to just say yes and move them as quickly as I can, no matter what. That's my role now. I'm not to advocate for the patient, which to me strikes against the law. As an RN, I'm supposed to always be an advocate for the patient. But now I'm told just to say yes to the supervisor. They are the gods at night. Whatever they say goes. And if we're going to close down a unit, whether it's one central, two east, or what have you, and close it down. And then later on, FYI, sometimes when we close down, in the middle of the night, the needs exist where we have to reopen up again. But we don't have the staff. So those patients stay down in the ED, and there's other nurses here who can verify what I'm saying, will stay down in the ED until the next shift comes along, and then we could open up those units again. And I'm sorry, if I were a patient sick enough to be admitted into the hospital, Les, I think you could speak to this as well, you don't want to be waiting around in the emergency department for hours until you get a bed.
And can I ask what date this happened, or could you?
There's multiple dates. And that one, I can't give you the date. It's a while ago.
Because it's
now.
A little hard to research what happened without knowing.
I had it on paper at the time. I was going to do, and I think I did speak to Carol about it. So if you go back into your records,
need it in writing.
Did I give it to you in writing? I did not. Anyway, but it's in all honesty, it's not just that individual. Mm-hmm. It's an overriding issue. And I would hope, Steve and Michelle, that moving forward, and maybe you're already doing it, and I really don't know this or not, because one central right now is closed. We're rewiring for opening up 12 beds again, thank goodness. That's what I was told anyway. We're putting in for 12 bell systems. But at the same time, I've taken Herb, I've taken Les, I've taken Carol on tours of one central and showing you this unit needs to be improved, physically improved, because patients go into the unit and they feel like they're going into the dungeon. I've literally heard that from some of the patients. Anyway, it's closed right now, and I'm hoping, I'm being optimistic, that not only the call bell system will be taken care of, but actually the aesthetics of the floor will be taken care of. Because I have things there from back in 1950s that are still molding on the floor. I have paint jobs that's a mess, and it looks like they're going to be painting. And I know Michelle rolled out a color scheme and everything, and I'm hoping that all that is going to be applied to right now, since the unit's completely closed. We have lights over the beds that haven't been working for years. I've been trying to get them taken care of. I've been going through multiple directors, multiple managers, and these are patient issues that they see. And I'm sure it may not show up in the way you see your evaluations, but their impression is, well, I don't even have lights in the room that work correctly. I have molding that doesn't match other molding. I have dirty floors. We've already discussed this. And I have curtains that don't even match. We'll have one set of curtains on one side of the room to the other that don't match with that. The aesthetics is just, it's just not appropriate. And I know we could do better, and I'm hoping that right now that's what is going on One Central, that it's not just going to be call light system, but you're going to take care of all of that while there's no patients there right now. That's the best time to do it, as you know. Once the rooms are opened up again, then I'm going to be told, well, Hank, we can't replace that light right now because we got to wait until the room's unoccupied. And then this was going on for 4 months, 1610. There was a light in there that wasn't working. And because we kept transitioning patients out and all this good stuff, it wasn't getting fixed. And it wasn't my director's fault, because she was frustrated too. She kept putting in for the improvements. We were calling plan ops, and they're saying, well, we can't do it until the patients are out of the room. And now there's a light in room 4 that I'm told, oh, well, the electrician needs to take care of it. Well, the room's closed now. Well, why can't it be replaced? And then there's a light, overhead light in room 16-7. Once you open it up to turn it down, then you put it back because this metal thing sticks out. Why couldn't that be fixed?
Thank you,
as a nurse, it's frustrating.
Thank you, Hank.
Okay, and I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you for being a patient advocate.
And I'm sorry I didn't plan on speaking, but I'm hearing about these things, and it's like, what are we doing about it?
We appreciate your role, but that's very important.
Okay, thanks.
Anybody else have anything to say? Love that. Okay, anybody else have anything to say? Mr. Hoffman?
I saw through the presentation that nurses have an exceedingly important role in this whole process. And one of the things I noticed in looking back at the statistics that the hospital submits to the state is that even though there are 351 available beds in the hospital, you generally only staff 270 of them at any one time. And that the staffed occupancy rate for the first 3 months of the year was 99.81%. For the second 3 months of the year, it was 99.99%.
What year are you talking about? I'm sorry.
2017.
Okay.
Third 3 months of the year, 99.72%. And I guess things fall off at Christmas because then it was only for the last 3 months of the year, 95.45%. You can only do this if you park patients waiting for a shift change. I'd like to know, do all those patients in the halls, do they get a whiteboard? Do they get rounded? How does that work?
All right, what's our patients?
They don't need to respond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your comments have been recorded and we will respond to that, Mr. Cobb.
Thank you so very much.
Anything else? Well, let's thank everybody for attending. It was nice to have a full house. Please come to our next meeting. I'm not exactly sure of the date, but we are going to have the new patient safety officer.
Yeah, and we need to get contact information.
Yes. We'll get contact information for sure. So the next meeting will be posted on the website, and we'll let you know through our contacts. And the Patient Advisory Council, very, very, very pleased to have them. Maybe some of you can work together. Oh, yeah, Chris. So, meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Ezra.